Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Cochran, Judge Cleary, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. And welcome to the Court of Appeals, Wednesday, October 23. We are recording these proceedings as well as live streaming them. The audio recording will be available within 24 hours on the court's website. But for that reason, we do ask counsel to make sure to identify yourself for the record and who you represent when you begin your comments. We have the first of four oral arguments this morning. File A240623, State of Minnesota is the appellant versus Bobby James Jackson, respondent. And appellant's counsel, when you're ready, you may approach and begin.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Anna Light, Assistant Ramsey County Attorney, and I represent appellant, State of Minnesota, in this matter. It was a miscarriage of justice to dismiss this case, and we ask that this court reverse the district court and find that no speedy trial violation occurred in this case. The district court erred in finding that the third and fourth Barker factors weighed in respondents' favor. I want to explain the third factor briefly, but I want to focus our attention on the fourth factor because the question of prejudice is the most important issue in this case.
Counsel, before you do that, could I back you up to the reason for the delay? It seemed the record was mostly absent of any explanation. And my question, a broad question, is what isn't there a burden on the state in a case like this to present to the court the reasons for the delay so that the court can then analyze those reasons, not only for that factor, but really when looking at all the other factors and the balancing as well?
Well, I believe, you know, it's the defendant's motion to dismiss. So it's the defendant's burden to show that a speedy trial violation has occurred.
But on that factor, there's nothing the defendant can prove. It's solely up to the state to explain the delay, and what was the explanation?
Sure, and I do agree the record is absent. The record is silent on the reason behind the delay.
And my question maybe is the procedural. Doesn't the state have the obligation to fill that record in response to a over 1 year delay? On its face, it would just seem like prior to this motion, the state already would have been saying, what's going on here? What happened? And so mm-hmm. You'd have that information, or you would get it once you see the motion if you didn't already have it.
Right. I don't believe there's any case law putting the burden on the state to fill in a record in this case. You know, in the district court proceedings, they set a hearing. The parties appeared at the hearing, and the state said, this is a legal question. We're ready to have a legal argument.
Counsel, let me interrupt just for a minute. Mm-hmm. If the government's been negligent, and I think you agree that they have been, mm-hmm. prejudice can be presumed if there's been an excessive delay.
Correct.
All right. And if we believe this being excessive delay, then we're back to how serious the negligence is on the part of your client, your office.
Correct, and I think that's the right question, which is why I believe that the prejudice question is the most important one, and whether the 1 year delay in this case can be considered excessive.
You agree that it can be presumed, though, due to the negligence.
So, if
there's been an excessive delay, we can argue about a year, but
yeah.
Again, I presume that we think that a year is excessive. Then the negligence leads to the presumption, does it not?
So as the protractedness of the delay increases, the presumption of prejudice that the negligence caused can increase. So they go hand in hand, and that's why it's important to look at, and the question really is, was 1 year excessive? And I want to push back on that.
How do you determine whether a delay is excessive? What is the standard we should apply?
Right. It's looking at, the case law says that the delay must far exceed the threshold needed to trigger a speedy trial claim at all. And so in Minnesota, that threshold is 6 months. In the federal courts, that threshold is a year. And so then you can compare it to case law that has found excessive delays. Minnesota courts have found that 12 years is an excessive delay, and we wouldn't argue against that. Doggett, the U.S. Supreme Court found that 8.5 years was an excessive delay. We wouldn't argue against that either. There are several federal cases finding 3 years not excessive.
Does the reason for the delay factor in at all to our determination as to whether the delay is excessive? In other words, here the delay was due to the state's negligence. At least that's what the district court found, I believe. Mm-hmm. So does that factor into whether it's excessive?
So I believe because the reason for the delay was the state's negligence, that kind of triggers the question of whether the delay was excessive enough in order to allow the courts to presume prejudice due to the excessive delay. It's negligence.
It's purely a time question, whether it was excessive.
Right. Yep. I mean, I think, the Barker test is a balancing test. There's the four factors, but then there's all the other circumstances in the case as well to go all together. So I don't think there are bright line rules. I don't think there's a time stamp that we can put on that says everything more than 3 years is excessive, anything less isn't. So I think it's looking at everything in combination. But here we have 1 year and 7 day delay between charging and arrest. The defendant, then was brought into court, asserted his speedy trial right, so he could have had his trial within 60 days. From charging to trial, absent this motion, if he had gone ahead to trial, it would have been a little less than a year and a half from charging to trial. And when you look at our criminal justice system, unfortunately, it doesn't move swiftly sometimes, and especially in these complicated person crimes, getting to trial can take some time. And so I think you can also look at how long does it usually take a sexual assault case to go to trial? A year and a half?
Counsel,
I think that's typical.
Let me interrupt for a minute. It seems to me that in a way you're backdooring the argument that the investigation made the delay, but that's not in the record, correct? You're suggesting that cases take a while because of investigation, for instance.
For instance.
But we don't know the record for why this was over a year.
Correct.
Okay.
No, and I agree with that. The record is silent as to why the respondent wasn't arrested for that year. And we acknowledge that it was negligent. We acknowledge it shouldn't have happened. He should have been arrested sooner. He wasn't, and so now the question becomes, does this warrant the severe remedy of outright dismissal of a very serious first-degree criminal sexual conduct case? And we believe under all the circumstances of this case, including that there was no prejudice, that this court needs to conclude that a violation didn't occur.
Do you know that there was no prejudice?
I mean,
there wasn't a showing of actual prejudice, but the case law suggests that it can be difficult to show actual prejudice.
And that's true. So at the district court, the respondent asserted a few different ways that he attempted to show that he suffered actual prejudice. The district court rejected each of those instances, and the state agrees with the district court's analysis that there is no particularized prejudice in this case, no actual prejudice that can be shown.
When you say there's no prejudice, you mean there was no showing of actual prejudice.
Correct. And then to move on to whether this court can presume any prejudice, that goes to the question of was this an excessive delay that triggers a presumption of prejudice? And so that's where our argument comes down to a one-year delay, while unfortunate and it shouldn't have happened, it's not excessive under the case law and under the circumstances of this case.
I wonder, counsel, if maybe that's, again, what I was trying to ask at the beginning is, with a missing record on the reason, and we know there's different levels of negligence, if we're looking at the tort world, and so wouldn't the absent, the presence of that information then give, complete the record in terms of whether it's excessive? In other words, if it's what we might call standard negligence of the office was so busy and we had a bunch of things going on and we had a bunch of trials that were demanding, you know, that sort of thing, that gets to your point that, well, that's the world of criminal charging and et cetera. So given that, it's not excessive. But if on the other hand, it was just plain ignored, maybe there was some, maybe there's some negotiating on tangential related matter, something, just anything. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I'm getting at? Isn't that an important missing piece? And again, wouldn't the state be obligated to fill that so that the district court first and then a reviewing court has a complete record when reviewing these balance of these factors?
Yeah, I see what you're saying, and I think it probably would be helpful to this court to know more and to have a greater record of why, you know, whether this case, you know, someone dropped the ball, it slipped through the cracks, or, you know, there was a more of a reason why, as far as, you know, law enforcement being overburdened, charging desk being overburdened, whatever it was. But I don't believe there is no case putting that obligation on the state. And so I think if this court's opinion in this case came out saying the state didn't meet its obligation to explain the reason for the delay, I think that would be new case law. I don't think that is what the cases say. I think the record is what the record is, and so we have to go with the silence on we don't know the reason why, and so that's why the district court said it was negligence. There's nothing in the record to show anything intentional or deliberate on the part of the state. We in no way were. There's nothing in the record to show that the state was hampering, you know, attempting to hamper the defense intentionally. And on this record, it was negligent. And so that weighs against the state, and we acknowledge that. But it doesn't weigh as heavily against the state as if it was a deliberate attempt to hamper
the
defense.
If you only look at that factor alone, I guess what I was getting at is tying with Judge Cochran's question, it seems like there's some relationship to that emptiness in that part of the record to whether it's excessive. And it, would it be fair to say, even if it's not clear whose burden it is, that it ought to be considered against the state in that regard, because it's the state's obligation not only to bring the charges in a timely way, but to present the evidence when it's not?
I get what you're saying, and it's the state's obligation to bring to bring the respondent to trial, to bring the respondent to justice, and to ensure his speedy trial rights. So we take that on. I don't see the connection to whether it was excessive. That's not how I read the case law and determining whether the delay was excessive. I think that's more, you know, looking at was this so atypical, so protracted, so excessive that the defense must have been prejudiced. And here, what I kind of was getting at with the talking about just generally the timeline of charging to when he went to trial to show that that's not excessive is that defendants are often in that position of a year plus before getting to trial. And so and we often have trials a year or two after the event. Witness memories, you know, are usually still intact. Witnesses are still available. Evidence, you know, is available. So testimony can be gathered and the defendant can be given his fair trial, which is the bedrock of what the speedy trial right is all about. So we believe here the record just has, there is no actual prejudice and the delay was not excessive enough to trigger a strong presumption of prejudice to warrant dismissal of this case. To touch on the third factor, just briefly before my time is up, so the district court found that his assertion of his right at the omnibus hearing weighed strongly in the respondent's favor. That's incorrect under the case law. The case law says, Doggett says, that it's a neutral factor when a defendant asserts his right after the alleged violation has already occurred. So in this Doggett motion scenario where the delay is a pre-arrest delay, then after he's arrested, the defendant asserts his right. That's just essentially the defendant preserving his claim to be able to say that his speedy trial rights were violated, and so it's not, it doesn't weigh in his favor. It just is a neutral factor that allows him to go forward with his claim. So the district court erred in finding that the third factor weighed in his favor. That should be neutral. And then as we've been discussing, we also believe that the district court erred in finding that it could presume prejudice and that that would weigh in respondent's favor. So coupling all the factors together, balancing it against the seriousness of this crime, we believe that the district court should be reversed and this case should be allowed to proceed to trial.
But we are back to excessive delay. I mean, you're telling us it wasn't excessive. We're still back to analyzing that.
That's correct. Yeah. And I believe if the court, I tried in my briefing to lay out as many cases as I could find to show that no court has found where the reason is negligence and the delay was 1 year. I couldn't find a case that found that it could presume prejudice and dismiss a case.
But I don't know that you found a case that was exactly on point. Would you agree with that?
That's true. I would concede that all of these cases are different, and it's a balancing test looking at the specific circumstances of each case. So I'll have my 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank
Indeed
you.
You will. Thank you, counsel. And counsel for responding, when you're ready, you may approach and begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think you left a... No worries. Good morning. I'm Shauna Kiefer, appearing on behalf of the respondent, Bobby James Jackson. I am asking this court to affirm the lower court's decision. The decision found that Bobby James Jackson's right to a speedy trial was violated and dismissed the case. One of the things that Judge Sleater had pointed out was, did they plain ignore the state, that is, the right to speedy trial, and was there a record? I think Judge Cochran had been inquiring about that. On footnote 1 of page 6 in the order, the judge, Judge Gordon, talks about the fact that the state had submitted the reason that they didn't pick up Bobby Jackson was because that he lived in Minneapolis, and that as soon as they actually did issue something to pick him up, that occurred within 3 days. The Constitution safeguards potential destruction of evidence from disappearing or decaying to the point it can't be found or used with the right of a speedy trial. I'm arguing that the court should apply the standard of review used in Sterling and that the findings of fact should be examined for clear error, but review de novo the legal conclusions.
Counsel, can I inquire? You mentioned the complaint 3 days later. So it was a complaint warrant from the beginning, and that was from the previous October.
That's correct, Your Honor. And then there's another procedure. I can reference the footnote exactly. I don't want to misstate it, but when the prosecutor actually says, hey, let's put some gas on this case, for lack of a better term. But once a pickup and hold was issued, so as soon as the prosecutor says, I want a pickup and hold, it takes 3 days.
So just procedure, maybe you can help me. So the complaint warrant signed by a judge, and then it goes back to the prosecutor, goes directly to law enforcement, or where did it go? Or don't we know?
Your Honor, I don't know. I just know that as soon as a pickup and hold issues, it takes 3 days to get someone into custody and that they knew his address this whole time.
So does that mean a pickup and hold, a prosecutor can sit on a complaint warrant until they decide we want a pickup and hold, which is apparently what happened, whether negligently or otherwise, but, I'm guessing the record doesn't come, but from your experience in Ramsey County, is that how the procedure seems to work?
I would agree that's how the procedure seems to work. I can't confirm, I'm not a prosecutor, but that is how the procedure seems to work. Here, Judge Gordon analyzed the Barker factors and found that all factors weigh in favor of the defendant, all of them, whether slightly or not. That's on page 14 of his order. And Judge Gordon didn't take this decision lightly. This is a 15-page order, and he outlines the seriousness of these allegations and the faults of the state. When we're looking at the evidence missing, he talked about how there can be specific prejudice or presumptive prejudice. And he noted all of the concerns that counsel had raised about evidence and how it can fall off over time. That included the scratches to the defendant's back, a Metro Transit video of the complainant leaving with the defendant, that no witnesses were able to testify about what they heard or didn't hear in this apartment complex, and the victim had alleged that she was screaming. And fourth, that the apartment video of the complaining witness leaving and coming would be destroyed. And fifth, evidence of whether the complainant had uncouth people coming and going from the apartment as part of drug deals.
So, but the district court didn't find any actual prejudice. And so we're left with the question of presumptive prejudice.
Correct, Your Honor.
And what is your best argument that there, well, would you agree that to determine whether we should presume prejudice, we look at whether there was an excessive delay?
I think the excessive delay should be considered. I think, especially now that we no longer have statute of limitations on these cases, it's very important. And something that the state had brought up was the Hembolt case and the seriousness of this case. And interestingly, Judge Gordon found that the seriousness factor weighed against the state. Because if they're saying that this person is dangerous and could be harmful, and they know exactly where this person is, and they sit on that for a year, what are we rewarding when we allow the prosecution to continue with the district? So there's two arguments here. One is we're presuming innocence, and we're presuming that the evidence here could have been destroyed. There could have been favorable evidence, and it's no longer there. But second, when we're looking at public interest, we have an interest in prosecuting people in a timely manner for both the fact that they might be innocent, but also that victims deserve to have their day in court, and that if somebody really is a danger and you know exactly where they are, and they could be harming, and that was not the case here, but if that's part of the argument, then that factor should cut against the state.
And so the state's counsel was arguing that we should focus on the length of the delay in determining whether it's excessive. What is your best argument that the length of the delay here was excessive?
The best argument that the length of the delay was excessive is that in Minnesota, 6 months is presumed to be excessive, and this is over a year. And also that this isn't...
Is 6 months presumed to be excessive? What authority would you point us to for that?
I believe it was in Osorio. I could be wrong. I don't have it right in front of me, Your Honor. I'm doing that off of the top of my head. But that is cited in the briefs.
Well, I think Osorio says that the 21-month delay between the time the state charged Osorio and the date of his arrest is presumptively prejudicial, but I'm not sure it explicitly says that that was an excessive delay, although the court does say Osorio's acquiescence to the delay reduces the weight that we afford his claim of generalized prejudice. So to me, you could read that as implicitly finding there was an excessive delay and Osorio acquiesced to the delay, but not necessarily. I don't know. You could argue with that both ways, I guess.
I agree. I think that there's a lot of facts and evidence that was before the district court judge, and like all of your honors have pointed out, these questions about what constitutes the delay that makes dismissal appropriate are very fact-specific, and the case law varies quite a bit. And so I think that we should give deference to what Judge Gordon had in front of him when he was making this decision. The Helen Bolt case that was cited by the state as being a reason to find that the seriousness of this allegation warranted this case to proceed rather than dismiss, in that case, the court stated that the defendant in that case failed to point out that he was the reason for the delay of prosecution, much of the reason, agreeing to a delay on the record with his counsel. And here, Judge Gordon weighs the balance of public interest versus the defendant's and found that public interest weighed in favor of the defendant. Helen Bull also said that speedy trial is necessarily relative, requiring the balance between bringing criminals to justice and the interest of the citizen in being free from oppressive and vexatious delay. Here, the defendant's not the reason for the delay. In civil lawsuits where no liberty or constitutional rights attach, a plaintiff is not allowed to avail themselves to tolling of a statute for an out-of-state resident when the plaintiff knows the defendant lives out-of-state and has made no attempt to reach the defendant. That's from Mercer versus Anderson, 715 Northwest 2nd, 114 at 112, a Minnesota Court of Appeals case from 2006. No evidence in this case changed from the initial disclosure nor the suspects. Recently, the Minnesota Supreme Court addressed the issue where the state had made no attempt to reach a witness and held a witness is not unavailable for confrontation clause purposes unless the prosecutorial authorities have made a good faith effort to obtain his presence at trial. That's State versus Trifoletti. And I only have a Westlaw site for that. I apologize. 2024, Westlaw 2035602, decided by the Supreme Court in May of this year. And in that case, they stated, to satisfy the requirement of a good faith effort, the prosecutor does not have to exhaust every avenue of inquiry, no matter how unpromising, but the prosecutor must, however, exhaust some avenues. Similarly here, the prosecutor has failed to exhaust any avenues. Judge Gordon's 15-page decision outlined the Barker factors appropriately. He knew the seriousness of this case. He took his time. He talked about the seriousness and why the delay.
With regard to the third factor, do you think that factor was analyzed correctly? Can you point us to any case law that says that that would weigh strongly in favor of the defendant?
I can't point to any case law, Your Honor, that would weigh strongly in the favor of defendant. But I think even if it didn't, Judge Gordon specifically stated that the Barker factors, all of these factors, whether slightly or not, were in favor of the defendant. And we know that not one of these factors is dispositive, according to Barker itself.
Is there any case where there's been a delay of approximately a year and it was found to be excessive for purposes of prejudice analysis?
I can't cite myself, Your Honor, but I know that district court judges vary quite a bit and that it's certainly not out of the realm of things that have happened in district court. I think, again, it's so fact and evidence specific, it really should be up to the district court judges that have the information in front of them.
Osorio also was a pre-arrest delay, correct?
I believe it was, Your Honor.
One of the few cases, of course, the party cited, because there aren't many that are unique to that and this situation, correct?
It is unique, Your Honor. I agree.
And is that why perhaps you're conceding, to some extent maybe conceding, that the speedy trial, usually that's a bigger factor when obviously it's a post-arrest delay, that the court, I don't know if you're conceding this, seem to overemphasize that factor. It almost seems like an irrelevant factor in a pre-arrest scenario, doesn't it? I mean, for the reasons that perhaps you already argued and even counsel for appellants mentioned.
Well, I can't say he suffered any prejudice by being in custody because he wasn't, most definitely. But this case did arise from the Office of the Public Defender, and those attorneys have 100 cases or whatever their docket is, and any delay in charging decreases the chance that those very strapped for resources attorneys are going to be able to properly investigate and preserve evidence that could be destroyed. I think timely prosecutions of serious cases should be encouraged, and that defendants who face the detriment of possible evidence destruction with the passage of time must not be penalized because the government has made no effort to locate them. And I'll leave room for more questions if you want, and otherwise I'll...
Well, I had asked counsel for appellant earlier if the reason for the delay factors into whether it's excessive or not. I think she responded that the case law suggests it doesn't. And in looking at the Strobel case, I think she's probably correct in that regard. But can you address that question as well?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that even if appellant is correct in that regard, because the judge looked at all four factors and found that all four weighed in favor of the defendant expressly in his order on page 14, and we know that he had all of the evidence in front of him and took this very seriously, even if he was to weigh one factor slightly more favorable or one factor slightly less favorable. He's found that all of them apply in favor of the defendant. And I think that for that reason, this case should be affirmed.
What if we were to conclude that the judge erred in the analysis of the third factor?
That's a great question, Your Honor. Hypothetically, if Your Honor found that Judge Gordon had erred and gave too much significance to the third factor, I think that the fourth and the second and the first factors, since they all favor the defendant, respondent, would still favor affirming this decision and making district court judges who have to make these decisions and take the time to look at everything and analyze it more solid in their footing when they're making these decisions. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you'll now have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And before you begin, a question came to my mind. It goes back again for the reason and the theme of our questions that we've had this morning. You made a very good point about, of course, the standard case, that if you would have gone to trial and so forth. But isn't it true that's the wrong lens to use in this pre-arrest delay, which then brings me back to a lack of a reason for it? In other words, when we're talking about excessive delay, if there's no explanation and we could almost take judicial notice, there's no good explanation for mm-hmm. this kind of a delay when he's known where he's at. There's no question he hasn't moved, he hasn't absconded, he hasn't done anything to prevent it. Wouldn't that be fair for us to at least say the judge was correct that it was excessive to presume prejudice?
So I think there's a couple of things in there that I want to address. I think that goes to, so the record, I think, just goes to why we are not contesting the district court's findings of fact, and we're not contesting his district court's conclusion on the second factor, that it is due to the state's negligence. Because the record is silent, I think all we all can know and agree on is that the state dropped the ball, law enforcement didn't arrest him in a more timely manner than they should have, and we are agreeing with that and conceding that it was negligent on our behalf. So that goes to then this court being able to engage in a conversation about whether the 1 year is excessive enough to trigger a presumption of prejudice. And
counsel, let me interrupt, yes, because it goes to your point here. Given that the state isn't offering any explanation for the year delay, essentially you're asking us to give prosecutor's office a 1 year free shot because you're not giving us any explanation. Nobody after you will have to give us an explanation because we said a year is fine.
Well, and I don't think by reversing the district court and allowing this case to go to trial is saying that a year is fine. I think we all recognize, and that's why we're not up here defending law enforcement sitting on it for a year. We're not coming up with reasons to explain away the delay.
But doesn't the appellant in this case need to come forward with some explanation? When there's no explanation whatsoever, then it's carte blanche for a year. I mean, every case is going to be up to a year now, at least, maybe past that, without any explanation. Not investigation or this or that. No explanation. So you got a free year.
Well, and I disagree with that. I don't think anyone will read this case to give us a free year. And I also want to push back on the fact that delays in especially person crimes and especially sexual assault cases benefit no one. It doesn't benefit the state for us to have sat on this a year. The victim who suffered a traumatic event would have to get brought back into court after she's already moved on with her life and have to come in and testify. No one wants that. We don't want that either. So we will, it's our duty to bring defendants to court to ensure their speedy trial rights. No one's arguing with that, and we will continue to do our job. Something happened here. We don't know what it was that allowed this case to sit for a year and for the respondent to be free living his life for a year, unaware of these charges. And so it's not okay. And I don't think this court would be saying that it was okay. I think this court would be saying that was negligent, that weighs against the state. But when we're considering all the circumstances, the seriousness of this charge, and the fact that there wasn't actual prejudice.
Well, except that your argument is that there's no excessive delay for a year. So we're back to, it's circular.
It is circular. And I agree. And I think that what, you know, if this court says 1 year between charge and arrest is excessive, that triggers presumptive prejudice, I think that's something that no other case has said before. So I think that would be a new statement of law. But if that's what this court said in this case, I think then another additional question that this court needs to look at is the prejudice can't be minimal and the prejudice must be serious. So then the court needs to ask, well, what is the presumed prejudice of trial happening a year later? What, you know, have witnesses' memories deteriorated so much? Are witnesses so unavailable? Can we presume that they're unavailable after a year? Can we presume that evidence has been lost when the district court showed that, or found that no actual prejudice occurred? So I think then it's another question of how serious is the prejudice that we can presume in this case after a year.
Just to confirm, by the way, and I know your time is running short, so I'll try to ask it quick. You're not contesting a factual finding, but you are asking this court to reverse the court's conclusions from the findings of which you don't contest the facts.
Correct. So on de novo review, we're asking this court to find both the third factor is neutral and the fourth factor weighs in favor of not finding a violation in this case. So we ask this court to remand and allow the case to proceed to trial. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today, as well as the briefing in the matter. We will be taking the matter under advisement and issue a ruling within 90 days, our speedy 90 days. Very well. Thank you both. Have a good day.